As Neil advertised, I'll talk about the Dark Energy Survey. Here's one of our prettier galaxies. I'll give you a brief intro to how we measure the growth of structure with weak lensing with DES and show you some results. I'll comment on the late universe versus early universe tensions. And then I'll quickly poll you whether you want to hear more about H0 and sigma 8, or you want to see some cool results on galaxy clusters. I'll probably talk about the latter more. Okay, so that's my outline. Here's the linearized equation for the growth of density fluctuations that many of you are familiar with. You can see that there's gravitational instability given by the sign, there's Hubble drag, the expansion of the universe slows down the growth of structure, and there's nonlinear terms not shown here. But on large scales, the solution of this equation, coupled with an initial power spectrum of fluctuations, tells you how matter evolves. What do we measure? We measure correlation functions and other statistical measures. So I will talk about the two-point correlation function initially, but then also about other statistics. So this is the definition of the two-point function on the sky. X and Y could be the galaxy over density, the lensing shear, their auto and cross correlations. Please feel free to stop me, otherwise I'll go relatively quickly through this intro. So what do we do with a survey like DES? Well, we want to test some kind of theory. So we think a standard model of cosmology with parameters that describe the densities of dark matter, baryons, dark energy, and neutrinos. Maybe a two-parameter description of the power spectrum of fluctuations and the expansion rate of the universe, in particular the Hubble constant, the rate today. So with the assumption that dark energy is the cosmological constant, the minimal standard model is the lambda CDM model. And we also test the WCDM model where dark energy is allowed to evolve in time. And your colleague, Jesse Muir, is testing extended models that go beyond these. So I won't talk about that, but I'm sure you'll hear about it from Jesse in the new year when her paper will be completed. So we compare these measurements to predictions of this model using MCMC sampling of this parameter space. And in practice, a lot of the effort goes into the fact that we have these six or seven parameters from theory, but 30 to 40 nuisance parameters that characterize all of the uncertainties. But I'll talk only a little bit about that. And then we can answer questions like, is the model a good fit? What are the values of the parameters? Do they agree with theory? Is there some alternative that does better? Okay, so that was my quick intro. Let me keep track of time here. So let me show you results from DES. So this is data taken with this pretty ancient 4-meter telescope on a beautiful mountaintop in Chile. But the telescope does have a really gigantic and modern camera, which enabled the survey over a period of 6 years. So this is a picture of a nice nearby cluster taken with this camera, and you can see the scale in kiloparsecs. That image occupies that yellow region in our focal plane. And that's the size of a single exposure relative to the size of the moon. So we take a whole bunch of these exposures in five different filters and tile the sky. And when we are done, we have in the southern sky this peculiar looking footprint, but you can see most of it is pretty contiguous and it's 5,000 square degrees. So this is the largest imaging cosmological survey. The full survey will map the images of over 200 million galaxies. The results I will show you is about half of this data. So just to give you some kind of lay of the land, the Dark Energy Survey, the Subaru HSC Survey, and the KIDS Survey are all competitive ongoing analyses, and the strengths, and you know, they have some complementarity. They, for the most part, see different parts of the sky. DES has, you know, the numbers, the total area, the field of view, the number of galaxies. HSC has the best resolution and is the deepest of the lot. And KIDS is somewhere in between, but it has the best wavelength coverage because it has near infrared, infrared data over a lot of the survey as well. So I'm happy to answer any questions, but that's my 2-minute comparison of different surveys. I now show you results based on the analysis by many of these folks. The people at Penn are postdocs Marco Gatti, Cyril Du, Carlos Sanchez, and Marco Riveri, who work with Gary Bernstein and myself. Grad student Shivam Pandey, who's graduating next semester, and Lucas Secco and Taeyeon Shin, who graduated last year. Lucas is now at Chicago, Tae at Stony Brook. I also have a really fun and talented group of undergraduates whose work I mostly won't be showing because they work on far out stuff like Oort clouds, but also some on galaxy clusters. There's a very large number of DES collaborators, and I will be showing some results directly from these folks, but I will show you a list of all the papers where you can see their names. For now, let me introduce lensing. So as you know, if you have a bunch of images of distant galaxies shown in cartoon form here, then a big lens will distort these images in this kind of tangential pattern. But in a random line of sight, the distortions that we'll be talking about are typically at the 0.1% level, the coherent distortions. And we measure them through these two-point correlations as a function of separation on the sky. Before we get to those, we have to start with raw images like this. So this is one exposure in one filter. And you can see that the image looks like a mess. There's satellite tracks, cosmic rays, and all kinds of distortions that are dealt with in a pre-processing stage. And then with the processed images, there's an extremely elaborate exercise of measuring the shapes of the galaxies and their photometric redshifts. I will not go through this logical chain, but this is a representation of many different steps involved in going from images to redshifts and shears, to clustering measurements, and then combining elements of simulations and theory to infer cosmology. Any questions so far? I can't see most of you, so you'll have to speak up. Okay, so I'm gonna jump right away to one of the products of our lensing analysis, which is the use of 100 million galaxy images to get this map of the mass distribution. So you've seen CMB lensing mass maps from Planck that are all sky. This is 5,000 square degrees, so it's not all sky, but it's the largest mass map with a galaxy survey. And so you go from a shear catalog to something like the Kaiser-Squires reconstruction algorithm to get the projected matter. And with this, you know, this is quite heavily smoothed, but you can still see in the red, the overdensities that have this filamentary network across the sky, and in blue, the voids. And you can see some of the non-Gaussian nature of this projected mass distribution. This was work led by Niall Jeffrey and Marco Gatti. So stepping away from the mass map and back to the galaxy catalog, this image on the right shows you schematically the measurement of the clustering of galaxies. The crosses show the foreground lens galaxies. The blue ellipses show the background galaxies that are cross-correlated with the lenses and also autocorrelated to get the lensing two-point function. So there's three two-point functions, the lensing two-point function, the cross-correlation, and W theta, the autocorrelation. I will mostly stick to just lensing results, but our main result is called a 3x2-point correlation function, which involves all three of these. So the lensing correlation function uses four subdivisions of the galaxies into four redshift bins. So you can see that in contrast to the lens galaxies, the source galaxies, the redshift distributions look like a bit of a mess. But there's a reason that these distributions come out that way. The reason is that we want to be super confident about their mean and spread. And there's various techniques used to ensure that those are very well calibrated. And the one price we pay is that they have significant overlap that we can forward model. You can also see that the lens, the galaxies live between redshift 0.15 and 1.3 or so, is where most of the galaxies are. So this is the two-point correlation function of lensing. Oh, sorry, I meant to write down the formulae for these estimators. So, you know, the lensing shear is a complex number. It describes, if you like, the axis ratio and orientation of the ellipses. And so because it's a complex number, you have two two-point correlations that are typically decomposed into this xi plus and xi minus. So given some angular separation in the sky, xi plus is the sum of the two components, the tangential and cross components, and xi minus is the difference. And the panels show the redshift binning. So 1.4 is the cross correlation of shapes in the nearest and the farthest bin. And 4.4 is the autocorrelation of two galaxies in the farthest bin. So you know, you look at these plots and you realize that it's hard to get an intuitive feeling for a data vector. There's a whole bunch of panels with a whole bunch of points, and you can appreciate that the best fit curve, the lambda CDM shown by the green line, is a pretty good fit to the data. But beyond that, there's not a lot intuitively you can say by staring at these. You just have to do your analysis. The purple bands show the data that we discard. So on small scales, we don't attempt to model the effect of baryonic gas. And we our model is just a pure gravitational non-linear, but a gravitationally evolved power spectrum. So we discard the data on, you know, typically 5 arc minutes and less to protect ourselves from the effect of baryonic contamination. So the signal to noise in all of these is 40. And so that's the state of the art with lensing.
Can I ask, so it seems that you've discarded, you discarded a larger range of scales for the minus correlation than the plus. Is there some reason for that?
Yeah, the decision is based on looking at the 3D power spectrum and looking at a bunch of hydro simulations that show, you know, different levels of deviation. And then we set some tolerance. So when you look at the window function of psi minus over the 3D power spectrum, a given angular scale goes to higher k. So if you wanted a cutoff in wave number or megaparsecs, you end up with losing more of psi minus. Okay, so as I said, a lot of the work goes into modeling the uncertainties. So we have what we call an astrophysical model. So like I said, we try to throw away the data that we think is contaminated by baryons for lensing only. The two other effects are magnification and intrinsic alignments. You know, there's many more, but they are subdominant. Intrinsic alignments is the fact that galaxies interact in space with each other. And so even a galaxy that we think is, okay, so galaxies interact in 3D space with each other. That's called the II intrinsic alignment. And there's one more, which is that a background galaxy that's being lensed by a foreground galaxy, the matter that's lensing it has a tidal interaction with a nearby galaxy. So even galaxies that are separated quite a bit on the line of sight and in different redshift bins have this intrinsic alignment. So this is a significant contaminant of the lensing signal. And so we model it using two different models called the NLA and TAT for tidal alignment, tidal torque model, and we fit for the parameters of these models. So this panel here shows the different intrinsic alignment contributions to one of the measured correlations relative to the full signal. And you can see that at the scale cut, it's more than an order of magnitude below for these choice of parameters. We also have these calibration parameters, which is that when you measure a galaxy shape, you deconvolve the PSF one way or the other, and that correction has some uncertainty. So the amplitude of the shear is uncertain at the percent level. So we put some parameter with some prior to capture that calibration. Similarly for photosees, and this is per redshift bin. So it all adds up to more than 30 parameters. For the galaxy clustering, galaxy lensing cross-correlation, there's additional parameters for galaxy bias. So here's one example of the kind of tests that we do. These are four different variations of the intrinsic alignment modeling. And they show that you can get some differences in the cosmological parameters, both the size and location, but they're entirely consistent with each other. So I can talk more about this, but I won't take a lot more time right now. Is a question from Subhadeep?
Hi, yeah, I have a doubt, like how do you estimate the systematic uncertainty?
I can answer that only one at a time, right? So for the intrinsic alignment, we have this model and the redshift, we have four redshift bins and we measure all the auto and cross correlations across these. So the intrinsic alignment can be significantly degenerate with the signal in any one redshift bin. But when you simultaneously fit for all of them, you can measure both the intrinsic alignment parameter and say S8. So in fact, one of the interesting results we got, I'm not sure I have a slide on it, is that we see no detection of intrinsic alignment signal. And some of the theoretical expectations, what cosmologists would have considered worst case should have been detected at a few sigma. So it appears that intrinsic alignment, when you look ahead to LSST and stuff, we'll be able to put some priors that will lead to less degradation than we had expected 1 year ago. So that's how we fit for intrinsic alignment. For calibration parameters, we just have a parameter that is marginalized over, and they all lead to some degradation in our cosmological constraints.
I was just wondering whether this 2% amplitude uncertainty can be like 5% or so, depending upon the model of for calibration you're considering.
I mean, we present all these cases. So for example, we chose beforehand this model, the TAT model, which has five parameters which has five free parameters per redshift bin. And then when we were all done, we realized that this model is too complicated and we really didn't need it. And we could have stuck with this NLA model, which has only two parameters. And when we use that, we get tighter constraints. So everybody likes to say their analysis is conservative, but this is one case where we truly are the most conservative analysis in the field. And if we did what most others did and what we did in our year one analysis, we'd get tighter constraints. So yes, it can go either way.
Okay, thank you.
All right. This is to put to rest any other doubts that you might have. This is now sort of a standard thing in the field where this is our S8 constraints, this is Planck, and so this is the familiar sigma 8 tension, which is, not very severe here, but these are many other variations. So you may or may not care about all the systematics. The different ways of estimating photo Z's are here. But one thing you might be interested in is, we do use nonlinear gravitational evolution. And so if you use the half of our data vector on small scales, you'd get this. And if you use the one on large scales, you'd get this. So just in case you were wondering if, you just stick to the linearish regime, the sigma tension is more or less unchanged because the central value shifts to lower values and the error bars go up.
Bogus, neutrino mass freed up in all of these?
I'm blanking on what our fiducial choice is.
Yes, neutrino mass is varied.
Thanks, Jesse. So neutrino mass is freed up, and it actually causes us a little bit of trouble. And there's a case to be made that we should have just fixed it because we are not yet sensitive to neutrino mass. And there's some degeneracies that lead to projection effects. But yes, that's the answer, that it's freed.
Thanks.
So this is our main result. Oh, I should have mentioned, I had the pictures of Alex Amon and Lucas Secco, who led the two cosmic shear papers. Lucas Secco and Simon Samaroff were the leads of one of them. So these are two equally important complementary studies of the cosmic shear analysis. So here are the results in this S8 omega matter parameter space. So S8 is sigma 8 times omega square root of omega matter. So one thing you learn when you do low redshift cosmology is that even to describe the amplitude of fluctuations, there's no unique parameter. Sigma 8 is the amplitude of the 3D mass density fluctuations, but of course we never measure those. So redshift surveys measure sigma 8 times, F, which involves some power of omega and bias. and lensing measures, you know, potential gradients, which involve that, which are, you know, potentials are deeper depending on the absolute mass density. And so S8 is the natural amplitude parameter, and it's sigma 8 times square root of omega matter, roughly speaking. So in this parameter space, these are our constraints. There's two variations. The dashed lines use slightly more aggressive scale cuts, which I personally think are the appropriate ones to get all our information. And these are the 68-95% constraints, and this is Planck, and you can see that they are consistent at the two sigma level. When you compute the tension in the full parameter space, it's closer to 2.5 sigma. So in our papers, we characterize this as consistent, but you're welcome to make your own conclusion. Okay, so I wanted to show you some new stuff based on a paper that came out a few weeks ago and another paper that's in preparation, which is about three-point correlations. So there have been a number of theory papers that say that, you know, from lensing in particular, the two-point function gets only half the information. It gets only a quarter of the information. There is not yet some kind of community consensus on the most reliable way to get at the other, let's say, half information. So, you know, I'll show you some approaches that involve deep machine learning and other fancy stuff. And I like to joke that, you know, we are slow. We're counting from 2. We've only got up to 3. So that's all we are doing, three-point functions. And that's complicated enough. So this shows you a triangle on the sky. And at each vertex, you can measure 2 components of the shear. So you can get 2 × 2 × 2, 8 three-point correlation functions as a function of the 3 variables describing a triangle. So I know some of you have thought about bispectra and three-point functions. So you know it's, you know, significantly more complicated than the two-point function. So this is, embarrassingly enough, an 18-year-old paper in which we did a halo model prediction in the shown by the curves and compared it to ray tracing simulations of this three-point function as a function of opening angle for an isosceles triangle. And 4 of those 8 functions are shown here. And you can see that the behavior is quite complicated. So unlike those, you know, almost power law two-point functions, here there's some complex behavior that it has to do with the spin 2 nature of the shear field and gravitational, the nature of gravity. And so this is, to me, an exciting plot, because after 18 years, we actually have a measurement of this from the data. So this is work led by Luca Secco and along with Mike Jarvis, Chi-Wei Chang, and Marco Gatti. This is in preparation. It's an internal review. And here, that same isosceles triangle three-point function is shown as a function of opening angle for 2 different scales. And you can see that, you know, for one size of triangle and one particular three-point function, we are getting 2 to 7 sigma detections. And the dashed curves show the measurements from ray tracing simulations. So, so this is what we are doing right now. At first brush, you can see that the measurements are consistent with cold dark matter cosmology and Einstein gravity. You know, we study where the information is coming from as a function of all those 3 angles. And then we compress all that information into these map statistics. So it's like a skewness statistic. And here I'm showing results from two redshift bins. And so there's the auto third moment of one bin, of another bin, and the two crosses. And you can see one of these is is detected at 13 sigma, and the dashed are the predictions of simulations. So this is work in preparation. There's a slightly simpler statistic that we did the full analysis of. This is simply the third moment of the convergence. So these are all closely related. And there's just a number of practical considerations behind what we do. So one third moment analysis is completed all the way to cosmology. The other, which is a much more detailed look at the triangles, is in progress. So this is the one that's completed. I'll just jump to the cosmology constraints. This is work led by Marco Gatti, who led a methods paper 2 years ago, and the application to data came out last month. So this is sigma 8 omega matter. Red is the two-point function. Green is the three-point function. You can see the size of the contours is bigger. The third moment is less constraining. But you can also see that the degeneracy directions are different. So when you combine them, the gray contours are tighter. This is the same thing in S8 omega matter plane. So, you know, there's nothing earth shattering here, but one thing that was somewhat amusing slash interesting is that the third moment by itself is in 2.8 sigma tension with Planck. So this is, to me at least, interesting because, you know, when you measure a two-point function, you always worry about additive systematics. Any source of contamination, generally just that you aren't aware of, adds power to your signal. You know, in principle, we think it would add equally to E and B modes, and we check the B modes, but in practice, it can preferentially add to either. So it's very hard to have a direct test and proof that your two-point function is not contaminated. With a shear field, the three-point function is much harder to contaminate in a way that, you know, would pass your tests. So this is a pretty interesting consistency check that, that there is some tension and that that's about the level.
Abhuv? So for your previous slide, the previous one, the one where you're showing like the third moment of kappa as a function of,
yeah, right. This one.
Okay, so those contours were based off of these measurements, or?
Yes, exactly, yeah. So this is what we do use for the parameter analysis. And yes, it looks like a mess. But you're welcome to stare at it and find anomalies. You can see there's a number of two sigma, well, more like 1.5 sigma deviations, but the points are pretty correlated. So where you see a bunch of them that are one sigma below, that isn't even a two sigma issue.
Okay. So things like this, like 422 bin or something, you're saying that this is only like a sigma or something?
1.5, yeah, maybe.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Thanks.
So I'm looking at the time. So I won't talk about this analysis, but there's also an analysis of lens and peaks led by Dominic Zürcher in Zurich. And finally, I'm jumping here to a previous data set of kids that was analyzed by Yannis Fleury et al. Using a convolutional neural net. So I definitely don't have time to talk about this, but this is the amazing, scary future where you take your kappa map and you run a convolutional neural net over it you've trained it on a bunch of simulations. The simulations are designed to capture all possible variations of cosmology and baryons and intrinsic alignments and everything. Because in this game, you have to forward model everything. And then you train your neural net, you run it on the data, you get the blue contours, and they are, as advertised, you know, more than a factor of two smaller than the green based on the CLs. But this was a completely blinded analysis. They're certainly consistent. So there's, you know, exciting theoretical work on this kind of field-based inference using Bayesian hierarchical methods and neural networks. So one of the lessons we've learned from, you know, doing something more modest with three-point functions is that it takes a really long time to develop reliable machinery. Simulations are indispensable for both. For two and three-point functions, simulations and the data itself enable a number of robustness tests. So that's work in progress on how you can do a comparable diversity of robustness tests when you're doing machine learning. We also have analytical tools. You know, eventually we calibrate them with simulations, but even so, perturbation theory and the Halo model give us quite a bit of confidence and some physical intuition. I don't see that happening for machine learning methods, but hopefully I'm wrong. But there's two exercises that we're starting to do. One is to project a CNN onto known statistics to see how much information it has in common with these. And the other is kind of a blind challenge, which is probably a multi-year challenge that I'm just in the process of launching with Francois Linus, Elizabeth Krauss, and my colleagues at Penn, in which we will hopefully reach the point of giving a blind survey data that we've generated from a simulation, and people with deep learning codes will be able to see if they were missing some key systematic that we've included and it completely misled them, or whether their analysis is robust. Okay, that's the main part of my talk. For completeness, I wanted to show you the results of what we call our 3x2-point data vector, where we have lensing and galaxy-galaxy lensing and galaxy clustering, and this panel on the right shows the combination with these two by two point data vector and a fiducial result shown in gray. These are the numbers we measure. We are totally consistent with lambda CDM. And this is our set of 30 papers. And these authors are all people that you could consider inviting for talks, depending on which of these papers you're most interested in hearing about. One thing I didn't talk about that Shivam Pandey and Eli Rykoff and others spent a lot of time on is some puzzling results we found for our fiducial galaxy sample. So after we unblinded, we found that the galaxies had some decorrelation from the matter that couldn't possibly have physical origin. So usually you expect something called galaxy stochasticity at the percent level around 10 megaparsecs. We were finding it at the more than 10% level at scales larger than 10 megaparsecs. So Shivam and collaborators have nailed down some galaxy sample selection issues that appear to have been responsible. And meanwhile, after unblinding, we shifted our sample to a different sample that appeared not to have this issue. But the whole experience was a bit nerve-wracking and sobering. And we are fortunate that our cosmology as unblinded was robust to it. But we did spend most of the last year doing a bunch of tests to understand it better. And we learned a lot of lessons for LSST era cosmology, because LSST is probably has in its plans something, a very similar red selected sample of galaxies. So I'm happy to talk about details separately, but that's a whole other talk. So you know about the H naught and sigma tensions that I will not really talk about other than this slide. So I showed you the DS results, 2 to 3 sigma typically. Lensing alone is, you know, 2.5 sigma. This is probably still the most provocative plot of the tension. So this is a couple of papers, one led by Truster and the other by Haymans, that show a combination of 2 lensing surveys and BOSS, and they get an, 3 sigma tension in sigma 8 between the late time universe and the prediction from Planck. So if you're looking to build a new theory that jointly solves H naught and sigma 8, this is a plot you can look at, but the overall story is that this tension is still not highly significant. It's not at the 3, 4, 5 sigma level, in my opinion. Okay, this is my last slide on this DS stuff that Jesse and Agnes Ferti and others are working on. These very interesting set of extended models. And maybe they'll find some very specific beyond lambda CDM hint. One way to do it is to just compare, find a discrepancy in the predictions of lambda CDM. The other is to directly look at some modified gravity or non-zero WA, a sterile neutrino signature in the data. Okay. I know some of you work on clusters, and I'm excited about some new measurements we've made. What they mean and stuff is something we're in the process of understanding, but I wanted to at least put the measurements and some pretty striking features out there in case you have ideas to understand them. So this is this golden era of combining galaxy and CMB surveys, where we have put in a lot of bureaucratic effort to have memoranda of understanding between DES and ACT and SPT. And these are some of the results. So you may have heard from Neil and others about this idea of splashback, this boundary of dark matter halos. And we have been pursuing this boundary empirically with DES and even SDSS data for some years. This group of us, Eric Baxter, Chiwa Chang, Sushmita Adhikari, Tae Shin, and our collaborators. So this is the latest, greatest plot. So this is showing the lensing profile of galaxy clusters. To zoom in on the y-axis, this plot is R times delta sigma, which is the integrated lensing mass inside some particular radius, versus radius in megaparsecs going from 0.2 to 20, 30 megaparsecs. So the reason I said latest greatest is that for SZ selected clusters, we are now, you know, able to make precise measurements that you can do things with. So most of these error bars are at the 20% level. So there's a long story behind our decision to assemble the sample of SZ selected clusters. There's approaching 1,000 clusters in the sample. They're massive. The mean mass is, I think, 410 to the 14 solar masses. That the working with optically selected clusters has been quite a challenging path, and both the selection artifacts in these clusters and the resulting cosmology is still a work in progress. That's sort of the one-line description of probably a decade of nonstop work by many, many people. So we have found, as many people had hoped, that SZ selected clusters appear to be pretty close to a mass selected sample. You know, in detail, they no doubt have, some selection artifacts, but as best as we can tell, they are very close to a mass selected sample. So one striking result is that we also measured the galaxy profile that I'll show you. We fit it to a model. We scale the model along the y-axis and overplot it with this gray band. And you can see that at this 10%, 20% level, the lensing and galaxy profiles agree perfectly. I was not expecting this, okay? The linear bias regime of galaxies is supposed to end around here. And this is the notorious transition regime where you often see factor of two scale dependencies. And this is the inner one halo regime where tidal disruption and quenching and all kinds of violent things happen in clusters. But apparently, just a simple magnitude limited sample of galaxies shows no scale dependence. So that's one result. The other is that we detected the splashback radius, which we had detected previously with optically selected clusters, but then we got worried that could this be an artifact of the selection of the cluster itself? But with SZ selected clusters also, we see a clear minimum shown here in the log derivative of that fitted profile. And again, galaxies and lensing and theory and everybody agrees a little too well. This is the inferred 3D profile. So we were puzzling about why aren't galaxies showing some radical departures from the dark matter? So here's a model where we do linear bias, and then we model this infall regime and this one halo regime using the prescription developed by Dimokratsov and Neil and collaborators. So I think these theorists had realized something that we were slower to appreciate, that although a cluster is a very nonlinear object, around it, gravity is pretty well represented by a big isolated point mass. So, you know, it's close enough to spherical and it's so dominant that tidal effects and other effects in this regime appear to not play a big role, and galaxies just are really like tracer particles. So I won't have time to talk a lot about this, but in this paper, we did just like a one plot each comparison with perturbation theory and HOD model, which can easily show some strong deviations, but it is possible to develop an HOD model that also works, and hydrodynamical simulations that break down for some sample of galaxies, but for the simplest magnitude limited sample, don't do too badly either. So the picture that emerges is that we actually need a very simple, even analytical description of galaxies around clusters, and then we can use the galaxy profile. You don't even have to measure lensing to be able to do things.
May I ask?
Yep.
What is the blue bar from that point of simulation?
Oh, Anton, so your audio was sort of dropping out. Can you say that again?
Yeah, do you hear me?
Yes.
Yeah, I just wondering about the blue bar. Is it from dark matter simulation results or what? Blue bars.
I'm sorry. I again missed the first part of what you said. Are you asking about the blue?
I'm asking about blue bars. It's from dark matter simulation. I'm just wondering, or from the something else or not?
So this
is showing
the measurements from data.
Data. Okay.
And HOD predictions.
HOD prediction.
On the right is the illustrious TNG hydro simulation. And, you know, there is one feature in illustrious that there, when we matched our galaxy sample to theirs, they predict the smallest splashback radius. And it appears that their, even, you know, regular sized galaxies are suffering from not dynamical friction, but like this kind of self-friction where an infalling galaxy loses some dark matter, which enhances sort of the dynamical friction. So there's some deviation in illustrious. And the other thing where illustrious fails to match the data, that's in a paper led by a Penn undergrad that we put out Monday, is the blue galaxy sample is very different because they appear to have very rapid quenching. But these are very detailed questions that I won't have time to describe. I'll leave you with this slide where a grad student at Chicago, Daya Anbarjigane, working with Chi-Wei Chang and me, has measured the stacked Y profile. So now we're talking gas. Sorry, this plot is from a proposal that also shows what we expect to get in the future in purple. But anyway, the orange band shows the measured integrated pressure profile that appears to have a deficit at around the splashback radius. But we think the physics is quite different. This is like this merger shock that simulators have been talking about. And there's a possible accretion shock at much larger radii where the infalling gas meets the outflows of the cluster gas. So, you know, just for kicks, we have the first joint plot of lensing galaxies and gas from the data. It's kind of fun to think about what all one can learn from this. But we've only just got to this point, so I don't have much learning or theory to offer. So I'll stop there, and thank you for letting me go over a little.
Okay, great. Thanks, Boof. So let's all unmute to give him a round of applause for his great talk.
Thank you.
All right, thanks. So are there further questions for Bhuvnesh?
Hey, Mike. Oh, sorry, that's a clap, not a raised hand.
Okay, well, was there a question? Okay, if not, then maybe I can have something. So you mentioned this stochasticity result for red magic. Can you maybe just comment more on that? I mean, I didn't quite follow.
Oh, darn, I pressed some wrong button and now. Can you still see me fine?
I see you.
Okay, let me see. Yes, I'll explain it by showing one of our most worrying plots, if I can find it. So when we unblinded our analysis almost exactly a year ago, then then we got one of these contours. So the orange contours show you what we got by combining just the galaxy clustering and galaxy lensing. Okay, so this is quite a bit below our primary result. And Shivam and co then analyzed it a lot further, and they found that if they free up a parameter, so if they allow the bias of galaxies in clustering versus lensing to be different.
Wait, so sorry, just to clarify what that means, like, so when you say like the bias of galaxies in clustering, that means that you measure the galaxy two-point function and you say that is B squared times the matter two-point function. Okay. And like, is there like a white noise term also or not?
This is real space. So usually, so, you know, often people allow for the stochasticity parameter B times R. And, you know, in our basic analysis, we had tested and found that this parameter better be below 1%. So we didn't add a parameter. We just had a single bias that described lensing and clustering. But when we, after unblinding, when we then went and freed lensing from clustering, we found this blue result that our red, what's called our red magic galaxy sample, the ratio of these two biases was below one. And when you average all of them, we were getting 0.85. So a 15% stochasticity.
So remind me, it's the ratio of which to which?
This is lensing to clustering. Lensing, so clustering is too high.
Clustering's too high, or lensing is low, as Alexei likes to say.
So since then, Shivam has made a lot of progress working with Eli Rykov. So this revised analysis will appear in the paper he leads, hopefully in a couple of weeks, where he found that these galaxies were selected to have exquisite photozines. And there was somehow a price we were paying, because, you know, two identical red galaxies, one would get selected, one would not get selected, depending on whether they match the red galaxy template. And so on top of a color and magnitude selection, we were doing this selection on the chi-square of how the multi-band data fitted the red galaxy spectral templates. And when we relax that criterion, these blue points, I don't have that plot in front of me, but these blue points move towards one.
But why isn't there a higher redshift bin for Maglam? I thought Maglam went to higher redshifts, and maybe it does, maybe the highest redshift bin is just...
There is. I don't know why it's not on this plot, sorry.
Maybe it's off the chart.
It's so high.
right. No, Maglam is quite well behaved. And that was why we switched to that sample.
I think there was some concern about potential contamination for the two highest redshift bins for maglim. So for the fiducial analysis, those were left out.
Oh, I see.
That would be my bet why there's only four on the plot there.
Sorry. Okay. But just to understand just understand your explanation. So you're saying that, you know, for your red magic selection, you know, there was some random, almost like stochastic, like fluctuations in whether or not a galaxy would make it into the sample. Was that spatially varying, or not?
It had some spatial behavior. In order to, that's why it affected cosmology, you know, some relation to the density or some spatial variable that messed us up. Yeah. So, you know, this plot shows why the red magic sample was developed. It has the tightest red. In fact, this doesn't do it justice because, you know, we've chosen coarser bins. The red magic sample would allow you to have even tighter redshift distributions because its dispersion is like 0.02 in Z. But it turned out that in the implementation that we had used, it had some issues. And so we have not fully understood the causal chain, but we do now understand the parameter that caused this X lens less than one.
But the selection doesn't have like an explicit density dependence, does it? Or any kind of, and yet somehow there, wow, okay.
I mean, you know, one can speculate. I'm no expert on these topics, but you know, that a red galaxy in a denser environment is less likely to be a textbook red template galaxy than one that is more isolated, but this is just speculation. But yeah, just to address the earlier question, Jesse's right. Maglim, in fact, has 6 Z bins, and the latter two were not used in our analysis, in our fiducial analysis.
So can I have get some clarification on this. So this, when you say the clustering of galaxies is too high, is it the clustering between lensing and galaxies that's too high, or is it just the auto-clustering of galaxies that's too high?
I mean, we can only make the relative statement.
Right, I'm saying, but you have lensing autocorrelation, you have lensing galaxy cross-correlation, and you have galaxy-galaxy autocorrelation. So when you say one is too high relative to lensing, so which one is it? I mean, out of these three?
No, I mean, you have to use lensing to get the bias factor of the galaxies.
Yeah.
Okay.
Right. No, I understand.
Bias get is larger than we were expecting.
I'm just thinking, if you just add some random modulation in galaxy distribution, would that explain the effect?
From
your survey, yeah. Okay, so then you don't need density dependence of your selection. All you need is some sort of a structure in your selection in the sky that would boost your clustering of galaxies, right?
Yes, so that mm-hmm. was the first thing that we mm-hmm. examined, you know. You know, one thing we have in DES is that we have a little bit of a many flowers bloom approach. So people had already developed 2 galaxy samples fully. And for each sample, people had developed multiple ways of estimating W theta. You know, how do you marginalize over, you know, seeing and extinction variations? So we immediately looked at the results of 3 different ways of doing that, and that does not appear to be the cause.
Okay.
And the most recent test, that relaxing the photo Z requirement on red magic restores sanity, is further evidence of that. So, you know, because some of you are interested in these issues, I've shared all the the dirty laundry, because of course that's where life is interesting and messy. But I should reiterate the bottom line that with both our galaxy samples, when you do the 3x2-point analysis, you get the same result. This excess stochasticity was marginalized out when we combined with lensing. Mm-hmm. So this was kind of a nice validation of this 3x2-point approach. But it was, you know, still a surprise. For the last decade, we've always worried that lensing shear is so hard to estimate. How can we control it to 2%, let alone 1%? But now we are really confident that the lensing measurement uncertainty is below 1%. The dominant uncertainty is actually intrinsic alignments and variance.
Cool, thanks.
Are there further questions for Vu? I see that we've already kept him 10 minutes past the hour. I apologize for that. Okay, so if not, let's stop the recording here. Thanks again, Vu, for coming out. Let's all applaud once again.
Thank you all. Thanks for staying past the hour.